So can you sort of start us off by sort of telling me what got you involved in greening in the first place?
Well, probably like most people, I saw the women dancing on the silo that Christmas, or New Year's Eve, wasn't it? I was very impressed and just thought that that was rather wonderful publicity for their campaign. And then the next thing I knew, I was being instructed to represent them at their hearings in Newbury at the Magistrates Court.
Oh, wow.
Because Jane was the solicitor, the instructing solicitor, and with my colleague in Chambers, Wellington Street Chambers, Isabella, we were instructed to meet the women and to represent them. And so we went along to several meetings, and at least one of them was at the Mary Ward Centre, just to talk about what the women wanted to say, what the issues were, for us to give them advice about what the issues were. They were being, they'd been arrested and they were being brought before the court to show cause why they should not be bound over to keep the peace. So it wasn't an actual criminal charge, but they were going to a criminal court to see whether or not whether they should be bound over. And so there's various stages. So there would be a hearing and the magistrates would have to decide whether the behaviour that they had engaged in was likely to cause a breach of the peace. And then if the magistrates decided that, yes, dancing on top of the silo would cause a breach of the peace in the middle of the night, as you can imagine, unlike dancing anywhere else in the middle of town on New Year's Eve, they could be required to be bound over to keep the peace. And if they refused to be bound over, then the only possibility was to send them to prison. And so that's what the women were facing when we were doing the trials, the hearings, that if they would not agree to be bound over, because we knew that they were going to be found to have caused a breach of the peace, and we knew they were going to be required to be bound over, and we knew they would not accept it. And so then we knew that they would go to prison. So what the women wanted to do was to use the hearings as another part of their campaign. And, of course, we could not be part of that. We were merely lawyers. So we would tell them what was possible, what was not possible, what if they did such and such, what the outcome would be. I mean, some of the things that they did not even tell us what they were going to do, like when they all came into court and began singing every response they made to a magistrate, as in a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, and we didn't know that was going to happen.
You could have called that. That is an unusual thing to do.
Very, very unusual. And so the magistrates, and this is Newbury magistrates, you know, these are lay magistrates at first. I mean, as time went on, they brought down a stipendiary magistrate, a trained lawyer, but these were lay magistrates, you know, just the good and gentle folk of Newbury. And they didn't know what to do. They had a court clerk. He was beside himself. Anyway, but he was forever having to swizzle around and tell them what they could or couldn't do, because they had no idea. And with this opera singing, so, you know, so the magistrate would say, is your name, Joan Doobry-Doo? And the Joan Doobry-Doo would stand and go, yes, your worship, and would sing. You see, all the answers were being sung. And so they sent them down to the cells. And so there we were, the barristers, with no clients, because they were all down in the cells. And so we carried on. And every now and again, Mr. English would advise the magistrates that they should check to see whether the women were ready to come back upstairs, and the door down to the cells would be open and you could hear them singing, and so the door was closed again and we carried on without them. But that was later on. I mean, in the early days, the first big trial we did I mean, it was an extraordinary thing. They had all these witnesses that they wanted to call, because what we had to do was find a defence for them,
yeah,
so that they could work around. And so the defence that we decided on was self-defence, that they were acting in as a sort of token way to try and defend themselves, their families, their children, and the rest of the world from this dreadful risk of cruise missiles, nuclear bombs. We all knew what had happened at the end of the Second World War with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so that is what they wanted to prevent, because they knew what the effects of a nuclear bomb could be. And that was Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were A bombs, and we'd now got the H bomb. So it was going to be even worse. So that was our defense, that we were going to, they were acting in self-defense. And that is a proper legal defense. And
is that the first time that anyone had used that defence for this sort of
activism? Yes, yes.
That's really remarkable.
Yes. Oh. Well, you know, we were talking to other people and people were giving suggestions. And in fact, a barrister who we knew, I knew, and I spoke to him about the case, and he said something about, what about self-defence or something like that. I can't remember anyway. And so then we discovered the... all the implications of the Genocide Act. And so we decided to use that as the basis of the case. And then the women decided what witnesses they wanted to call. And because of the defence, the nature of the defence, they almost had carte blanche to show how awful a nuclear explosion would be. And so... so we did have, who did we have? We had, a Canadian nun who came and gave evidence on how to make a nuclear bomb. We had a South African barrister, in fact, who gave evidence about conditions in the mines in South Africa where they were mining uranium required to make bombs. I can't remember. We had some other good people. I've probably written it down.
They were all outlining sort of all of the human rights abuses that go throughout the process, not just the end.
Exactly. Well, part, yes, because
everything that goes into.
I mean, in a later case, we had a case that took place in Highbury Magistrates Court after some women had been arrested for demonstrating on top of Holloway Prison, women's prison, where some of the Greenham women were being kept. And we used that hearing to give evidence about prison conditions generally for women. And so, you know, so it was a wonderful, it was an extraordinary thing. It wasn't just about nuclear bombs. It was just about women's position and women, you know, because it started off as women with children marching to Newbury and to Greenham Common, just talking about women's lives and what's important in women's lives and how women are treated. And so it was an extraordinary thing to be involved in. Yes, it was wonderful.
It sounds like a really strong reflection as well of that. What I understand from the camp is that, as you say, women would arrive perhaps with one agenda, maybe it's peace or whatever, and then sort of have their minds kind of laterally blown or expanded really by all the ways in which the kind of the different issues facing women and therefore humanity intersected. And it sounds like the case sort of does that as well. Mm. It's like they it sounds like what you were saying, that you that there was more than one objective, in that defending the women is obviously one objective, but perhaps giving press and status and strategy for other arguments was also part of the agenda. That's very interesting and shows that the women were getting quite smart by this time about how to try and get messages.
They were incredible. And so brave. I mean, so brave, because they knew they would be going to prison. They knew that would be the end result. And, you know, some women went to prison time and time again. So, and that must take a tremendous toll on you. But they did all sorts of crazy things, you know. They gave themselves different names. So, I mean, and the only one I can remember, I must have blotted the other ones out, is one woman called herself Isaac Hunt. So if you say that very quickly, that kind of thing. And another woman came to give evidence wearing a beret with, you know, the little toggle in the middle of a beret tied to it was a tampon that that she had dyed to make it look as if it had been used. And once they called as a witness, I think that the commander of the whole Greenham Air Base to come and give evidence. And as he walked up to the witness box, one of the women leapt up and did a citizen's arrest on him for, you know, for acts leading to genocide. Yes, you know, amazing. Conspiracy to commit genocide.
That's very, the serendipity is very pleased, isn't it? Because, of course, they stayed originally because when they did the first walk to Greenham, it was that guy who wouldn't see them. And so they just didn't go. So that's lovely they finally got to have
got
an opening.
Yes. And they just used the court process in different ways. I mean, at first, I think, you know, that the magistrates, the court system, just thought it was a bit of a joke. But as time went on and they got the kind of coverage, press coverage that they did, particularly in The Guardian, things like that, and people began to react very badly to seeing women going, you know, sort of shoved into prison day after day. And it, you know, and it reminded people of the suffragettes and everyone knew how bad that had been. And so they had to sort of take it more seriously and think about it. So that was... So then, yes, as I say, after a time, a stipendiary magistrate came down to hear the cases, a trained lawyer who, you know, who wouldn't stand any nonsense.
How did that change the feeling of, I mean,
well,
how things went?
I mean, it was different, it's true. I mean, he was much slicker and he wasn't going to have any nonsense. But even so, the women were not deterred and they would... some of the women didn't want to be represented. They wanted some lawyers to be there just to sort of make sure that everything went well. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to represent themselves. And sometimes they would use us for the prosecution case so that we would cross-examine, you know, the guards. And then they would do their own defence. They would sack us and then do their own defence, that sort of thing. So, I mean... You know, the case was so stupid, the prosecution case, and they had there was a guy, one of the guards, an MOD guard, Ministry of Defence guard, who worked at the airbase, and his name was Fred, and he came and gave evidence about what the women had done. I think it was about the dancing on the silo, and he called them GLCM, GLCM, and I can't remember. I cannot remember what they stood for, that stands for.
An insult, presumably.
But well, no, it was a word that nobody used. And he was saying, I could hear the women say, "Let's go to the Gluckums," and no one would say that. No, and the women were sitting in court going, "Oh, Fred," just calling out to him, "Oh, Fred, how can you say?" You know, and you could see him blushing because he, you know, he was being caught out. Yeah, it was awful. But anyway,
but because they didn't follow the rules of a court where you don't speak out, usually do.
No,
they just did. Well, they were sort of able to appeal directly to his humanity. In a sense, being honest about their emotional reaction.
I mean,
to him
and I seem to remember he kind of for a bit he kept saying, "You did say that, yes, you did," you know, and it got a bit personal. But poor old Fred. I mean, he was old. He was, you know, near retirement.
Had he been lent on, do you think, to say?
Well, I mean, or something, or he'd been helped, or you know, he might have said, "Oh," and then they said something, and. I mean, but no one called them Gluckums. We all called them silos, where the nuclear warheads were kept. But the women were, you know, because they did so many extraordinary things, which you probably know about. I mean, you know, going out at night because they used to do these trial runs through the country lanes with these nuclear warheads. And the women would lie down in front of them. They'd put sugar in the petrol tanks. They'd do all kinds of things, which, you know, were extraordinarily brave because, you know, they could have been run over. They could have been, it could have been an explosion.
And a few women did, you know, get hit by vehicles and this, didn't they?
Yes, yes. I mean,
one death and there's definitely a broken.
Really? I represented a woman who, because of the evictions, because at the same time they were trying to get rid of the women who were, you know, camping, and they kept changing the rules about, you know, you, first of all, women had caravans and tents, and then you couldn't have caravans, you couldn't have a tent. And so that's when the word bender came into the English vocabulary, when women began to make tents. Well, what would you call them? Places to live in, by bending a branch and putting plastic over it. Because then we did a case, a court case. Could you be allowed to vote from a bender?
Oh,
and that went to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal decided that yes, you could vote from a bender, and that is still good law. I am told that
Excellent.
People still rely on that. Yeah. So, I mean, they were doing all kinds of, you know, different, challenging, all sorts of different things. Yes, and I represented a woman who, during one of the evictions, when they would come and chuck women off, got hurt, and we sued the, I can't remember who we sued, probably the local authority who provided the bailiffs or whoever it was. And we won there because she was injured as she was thrown around because they were. So, you know, so the, there was always something going on, always. And
how long were you involved in all this?
Years, actually, yeah. well, so what did it, I suppose, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, 3 years, 4 years, I don't know. Yes, because I know my niece was born in 1984, and we were doing a Crown Court trial because, first of all, because the... being bound over to keep the peace can only be dealt with in the magistrates' court. But then the women started clipping the fence, and that was criminal damage. Once again, a token gesture to say, we're doing this to draw attention to the issue. This is the only way we can do it because it's to defend our family, Self-Defense Genocide Act. And so it was sent up to the Reading Crown Court. And... well, two things about that. First of all, yes, my sister was having a baby, and the baby was due, and it was lovely because we kept having breaks in the hearing because, you know, people would always say, I need a break. So we'd have a break. And all the ushers knew that my sister was having a baby, and they kept saying, has the baby come yet? And of course, it was in the days before mobile phones, so you didn't really know. I had to keep ringing up. But another thing that happened about the trial, which you may or may not have heard about, was that someone from the Daily Express infiltrated the camp and wrote a series of articles about living in the camp, and very derogatory articles saying that some women were making lots of money and living the high life and other people weren't. And that came out during the first of the first Crown Court trial. And so we applied to have the trial stopped so that, you know, I think the Americans call it a mistrial, but I can't remember what we call it. Anyway, we applied for the trial to be stopped and for it to be adjourned and started again. And that did happen. But it was a very unpleasant period. And in fact, I was giving a talk about this, about my chapter in the book. And a woman was there who you may have interviewed, I don't know, called, I think it was her name was Lizzie or Liz, and she had been responsible for taking photographs. And when I told this story about this Daily Express person, she said, "Oh my God!" She said, "Is that who she was? I remember her, and I didn't know. She didn't know." And wow. This woman had, and apparently there had been, they'd done a naked demonstration on the base or in the base, And the woman who came to the talk had taken photographs. And she said that this woman from the Daily Express had said, "Oh, have you got the photos? Can I have the photos?" And she just thought she wanted to look at them. But actually, what mum must assume is that she wanted to publish them. But anyway, she didn't. But yeah, That was rather extraordinary.
How were they treated by the press in general, and how did that affect them in the eyes of the law, do you think?
Well, The Guardian was very, very sympathetic. I mean, I've got various clippings, if you're interested in those, from the hearings. I've also got a few cuttings of those Daily Express articles.
Oh, great.
So The Guardian was very sympathetic. And I mean, it was a time, you know, that it was the early 80s. There was a lot going on. You know, it was Thatcher years. So, you know, we were building up to the miners' strike. There was the anti-apartheid movement all around Nelson Mandela. There was all sorts of, you know, kind of things going on. And we in my chambers, there were a couple of sets of radical chambers whose aim in life was to, you know, fight for truth and justice and human rights and so on. And so we were right in the thick of it. So, you know, there was a moment when a police officer was sort of standing outside my flat in Amherst Road, actually. And I didn't know what he was there for. And my phone went peculiar once or twice. And, you know, so I don't know if my phone was tapped. I don't know. But they were kind of sort of strange times. Mm. But I think a lot of people were very sympathetic because it was women. And it was, you know, and women talking about the war. And we were still close enough to the war for a lot of people to remember. Mm. The effects of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and CND, of course. We had, you know, Bruce Kent, who was the head of CND, he came and sat in the back of the court. We called the Bishop of Salisbury, I think, just to talk about, you know, peace, peace and love. So, you know, it caught the imagination. Yeah. I mean, people came from all over the world. You know, a group of women came from America to be there and from Europe. And I think it is true. A lot of women came and found refuge there to be in a community of women that, you know, that was very peaceful, and that, you know, the whole point was peace, and so for them it was a wonderful place to come.
Did the public get to see the trials, or were they closed to the public?
No, they, anyone could come.
And did people sort of come?
No, because it was in Newbury. Okay. Unfortunately, you know, because having said that, no, I mean, Bruce Kent came, and Tony Benn came. Lots of, you know, people did come, and journalists, and because it was news. I mean, it's a sexy story, you know.
And especially if they're going to possibly do outrageous things in
the
courtroom.
Yes, exactly.
I imagine journalists absolutely loved that.
Well, that's right. Although, strangely, they didn't cover that very much. I think the big thing was the women being carted off day after day to go to prison. But I mean, it was wonderful because, I mean, wonderful. I'd only just begun in practice. I was 2 or 3 years call. And here I was in the middle of this extraordinary, event, you know, historic event. And I mean, I had come to the bar specifically to work for women because I'd been working for Women's Aid before, and that's why I'd wanted to become a barrister. And here was this extraordinary event that was completely woman-centred, and where they were asking all the right questions and also doing wild and crazy things. I think there were some twins. There was a pair of twins who were identical twins, and so the whole thing of, you know, are you the person who clipped the fence, or are you the person who clipped the fence? And so that, you know, and then there were some other people who super glued their fingers together. I they just did all kinds of crazy, wonderful, exuberant things to, you know. So you never knew what was going to happen. But sometimes it was just so wonderful. They were so outrageous in court, and there was Mr. English, the court clerk, sitting there, kind of almost exploding. He looked almost like a Dickensian character, slightly sort of rosy cheeked and a quite chunky guy. And then these three magistrates sitting behind him, and he would just be seething and seething. And sometimes it was very, very funny. And Izzy and I used to just sometimes just have to kind of drop things on the floor so that we could look under the desk, because we were just laughing so much. But
well, in what way were they different to most people's behaviour in court?
Oh, every way. I mean, just, well, singing for a start. Yeah. Reading poems, you know, people would write poems. People would sometimes, sometimes people would sing a defence, you know, so they'd have written a song. And they would sing it, and it would be a very long song. And so we'd all sit there, la, la, la. And it would be three verses. And so Mr. English would say, right now. And so the women would go, let her finish. And so there'd be another verse, right now, let her finish. And so people, you know, so it was a bit like that sometimes. And then people would write incredibly moving things and, you know, tell really moving stories about why they were there and their history and what it meant to them. I mean, and they were fearless in a way, and they were using it as a stage. Mm. And I mean, in many ways, there was a person who was prosecuting. He became a Crown Court judge later, but he was very straight and strict, and he was always trying to, because we were so young, you know, he was trying to remind us what the rules of professional rules of behaviour were. But there was really nothing they could do, because we were the thin, you know, white line between anarchy in the UK and law and order, you know, and we were keeping it together, because the women knew that. I mean, I think we did provide something for the women that they knew that they could behave in a certain way, and if they went too far, we would step in and
stop them doing something. Yes, their own cause,
but otherwise, you know, and we would make sure that things worked. We would make sure that people did things at the right moment and responded at, you know, so there was that. But in the middle of what for the magistrates was kind of chaos, you know.
So this developed a great rapport with these women, because that's actually quite a delicate balancing act, it sounds like. You must have understood each other when to step in and when not to quite well.
Well, sometimes, sure. I mean, I think there were some women who found, you know, because that's always been an issue in the women's movement, you know, those people who, some of us, you know, some women would say we had sold out because we had become, you know, we were working with the man, so to speak. And people felt that, you know, therefore we were treated better and so on and so forth. Or we had advantages which they didn't have, or we'd forgotten our roots or whatever. But, you know, I was a working class girl, you know. Mm. I'd been in CND, I'd been on all the Marston marches, you know. Yeah. I'd been there, I'd done that. So, you know, anyone tries to say I can't be there, you know, I shall just explain myself. So, I think yes. And also there were some, you know, there were different personalities within the group, and because the way that they organised, I mean, they organised so well and made decisions together and discussed things. I think they knew that we had to be there. They knew that we had to do the business, really, and we enabled them to do it, you know. Ooh. So. Yeah, I think, you know, we got on quite well. Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm still in contact with some people from those days. So, yeah.
When you first, it sounds like you couldn't have been more ideal, really, to be sympathetic and to be championing their corner. When you first kind of got the brief, did you get any choice? Were you able to say, I want to do that or I don't? Or was it just, did you have to do it? And what were your sort of feelings about it, I suppose?
Well, there is a cab rank rule, which means as with taxis are supposed to take everyone, you know, the first person who asks them. So barristers are bound by that cab rank rule. Having said that, if you feel you are, you know, if it's not in your area of expertise or if there is any other reason why you shouldn't do it, I could have, I guess. But a case like that, you're going to leap on it like, whoa, guard it with your life. Yeah, no. I mean, it was just one. I mean, it's terrifying, you know, really scary because we were going up against the establishment, you know. And also, yeah, you were in a position where you knew that your clients were going to prison at the end of it, which wasn't going to be fun.
Do you feel they were treated fairly by the law?
I suppose it depends what you mean, you know.
I mean, it just seems odd to go to a cook in to a very ignorant person such as myself, but the sort of idea that you go to court and the outcome be predetermined, when in my innocent head it's always sort of, you know, it could go either way for you because that's the whole point of going to trial at all. If you know you're going to go straight to prison, you wouldn't bother to have trials and all the rest of it. But you were quite clear they knew that's what was going to happen.
Yes, because that was the only thing you see in an ordinary criminal trial. Even if you're found guilty, it doesn't necessarily mean you'll go to prison unless you've got quite a record. But with breach of the peace, there is only you agree to be bound over or you don't agree to be bound over. And if you don't agree to be bound over, then the only thing they can do is send you to prison. So I mean, one woman did at one stage say, of course I'm keeping the peace. I will agree to be bound over to keep the peace because that's what I want to do. I mean, there was a sort of irony in the whole terminology of what they were being required to do. But I think for a lot of the women, they knew that the headline was women going to prison. In fact, shall I just... I might just look it up.
Did they get any? Were they ever treated as political prisoners? How was their? And did they ever want to be? You know, was there?
I don't think. Well, they were only there for sort of a week or two at a time. It wasn't sort of long, but I mean that was the point of the case we did, the Holloway case, that we kind of drew a distinction. We called one of the women from Greenham who'd been in a cell when these other women were on the roof demonstrating, and she'd been in a cell. And so she came and talked about how she'd been treated, taken from the court, and how she'd been bashed around in the van and how she was really sort of dazed and confused, and she was put in a cell with an ordinary prisoner, and the ordinary prisoner had banged on the door to try and get some medical help for her, and the ordinary prisoner was put into solitary as a punishment for doing that. So, you know, so we were able to make those kind of points, which was quite nice.
And that's very like the suffragette movement, isn't it? Mm. A lot of women who were in prison through suffrage then campaigned for better rights.
Better
for women
prison,
in prison,
yes,
didn't they?
Exactly. So let me just see if I can find. Right, where are we? Oh no, I'm looking completely in the wrong place. I should be looking in here. Legal landmarks, or have I called it something else? Yeah, here we go. Oh yeah, so I'll just show you. This is This is a picture of me and Izzy having
a
conference.
Oh, it's like you're at sixth form.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's us too. And these, but these are the Greenham women, you see, and we're having a conference with them.
So how old would you be in that picture?
Oh, I was 32, something
like that. Really? Because you look very young. Maybe it's partly because the picture is sort of...
Well, Izzy was a bit younger than me, so she'd have been in late 20s, I guess. So, yeah, mid-20s maybe even. Yeah.
So were the Green women involved in all of the strategies when you were deciding on how to approach their cases? And
Oh yeah. You couldn't do anything without having a discussion.
Did that make things easier or harder?
It was harder. But that's a titty biz picture. Some of these pictures I've got from. This is about one of the court hearings. This is from The Guardian, December 83. And
oh, gosh.
So, yeah, that's...
And there's your name talking about
it. There's my
name,
that's right, yeah. And this is the Daily Express thing.
Ah, okay, yes. So some of the Green Women did talk about this and were very wounded because there's a lot of allegations about how they were mistreating children there and things like that. It's really unpleasant.
Yeah.
And they'd taken her in and lived with her.
Yeah.
You know.
And been nice with the.
Been nice. As they did with everybody.
That's the same. Yeah, there are just lots of.
Because there was a lot of tabloid dislike of the camp, wasn't there? They had a very hard time, I think.
Oh, that's another one. That's, what year was that? I can't remember. It's 1982,
I think.
Yeah. So,
and that's Helen John, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my auntie
that face anyway.
My auntie Sheila kept this one, so she's highlighted my name down.
That's very sweet.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that's probably about it. Actually, yeah, that's
it's
my
great. Leisure book chapter.
I think, and that's the cover.
Lovely.
Yeah, let's close that. See, whoops. So hang on, let me. I was trying to find my. Yeah, I don't think there's anything else.
So, did it change what you did afterwards, having worked on this? Did it affect the rest of your practice, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, yes and no. I mean, it was obviously an extraordinary sort of learning curve. Mm. But as I say, I mean, then there was the miners' strike and there was the anti-apartheid, then there was Clause 28. Mm. I was also doing family work at the same time. So there was lesbian custody cases and sexual abuse, which was just beginning to kind of be acknowledged by local authorities. Yes. I'm just trying to think. I mean, it was all part of it. I mean, it was a sort of an extraordinary thing, and I never did anything else similar to that. There was never anything. No, I mean, I was in court doing another case one day. It was Bow Street Magistrates Court, and suddenly a load of prisoners were brought in, and they were all wearing sort of boiler suits and covered in red paint, and they'd just come from the MOD, the Ministry of Defence. They were peace demonstrators, and they'd thrown paint all over the place, and they all went, "Oh, look, it's Liz! I can't remember. I don't know if I represented them on that day, but anyway. But so occasionally I would, you know, I'd do other groups of sort of peace campaigners. But
and sometimes there'd be familiar faces.
Yes. They'd get around. But
were there any things I'm quite interested in there were new ways the new defence, the way that they were defended quite creatively, or indeed things that changed the law kind of more ongoingly.
Well, there's the voting case.
That's remarkable.
In fact, yes, because that's one of the things I had to write about in my chapter, you know, how did it change the world? Well, they went to America, some of the Green women, and there was the American court case, and that also got a lot of coverage. And
is that when they took President Reagan to
court? Yes, yes.
We interviewed one of the women that I don't know, Uncle Sue had been involved in that.
Yeah, strangely he didn't turn up, no.
But it got a lot of coverage.
Oh, I know, and I think they got a lot of money as well.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
For the camp.
Yeah. Of course, I mean, the cruise missiles didn't come up, and what bits they were removed. The camp closed and is now back to common land. So, I mean, that's something wonderful. I'm just looking at what I wrote. And a lot of women, as you've said, became lawyers and social workers and so on and environmental campaigners.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I think they're very, you know, extreme methods of presenting their case have not been duplicated.
I was going to ask about that, actually, in relation to things like Extinction Rebellion, perhaps just like in the last year or so. Do you see kind of any similarities, or do you think there's things that activists could still learn from what the Green Women did?
I think they probably could. I mean, I mean, of course, yes, all of the, I mean, a lot of them are, you know, young people with a message. Although, having said that, of course, Greenham was sort of extraordinary in that, you know, it covered the whole spectrum, you know, older women, younger women, you know, grandmothers. My mum went to Greenham. You know, people did that. I mean, and it touched, you know, it really, really touched people. I think... And I think it was because it was women. I think people, you know, I think sometimes some of the peace campaigners, or not, you know, other campaigners for other, you know, excellent causes, I think sometimes people are put off because they feel there is a threat of violence or a threat of extreme behaviour. But the Greenham women, it was something. I mean, who knows? Maybe it's that's patronising. I mean, maybe the good feeling is patronising, is what I mean.
They certainly seem to be able to be very creative rather than just using violence as a default.
No, exactly. Well,
and to think harder in a way.
Exactly. I mean, there was no question of violence. I mean, that just was not on the agenda. And so, so there were all, you know, there was serious stuff, there was heartbreaking stuff, there was funny stuff. You know, they did it all. There was clever stuff, you know. I mean, talking about bomb making and, you know, uranium mining and, you know, so imaginative, so interesting. And I think, well, I would like to think that campaigners now would be able to use that if and when they are arrested. But I have a feeling that, you know, the authorities are slightly cannier now and wouldn't allow, you know, those theatrical things to take place. They would be much more controlling about
that. And that's because of Greenham.
Yeah, I think they've learned that. Well, I mean, who knows? Of course, as we know, people forget so soon. So maybe if another group of activists started to be interesting in Gort, maybe they'd get away with it. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, I just don't know. You know, it depends what they're charged with. It depends, you know, I mean, because it was always the threat of prison. It was always that which made it so much, you know, because these were decent, upstanding, middle-class people, not always middle-class, but, you know, fresh-faced, thoughtful people who were being sent to prison. And that seemed so unjust. I mean, you know, but I mean, the whole Breach of the Peace thing. I mean, I don't know if they use it quite so much now. I think it still exists, but there are probably other charges that are brought.
I expect the charges have changed a great deal around. There's a lot of laws that changed around as responding to or updating or being opportunistic around, depending on the circumstances, around terrorism and terrorism acts, isn't there?
Of course, yes. There
are more ways to arrest or detain people now.
Yes. Yes, I think, because didn't they do that just recently, some campaigners, wasn't it? It was about...
Was it Sunset 15, maybe?
I think it was, wasn't it? They got on the plane or whatever.
And laid down and, in front of it.
Yeah, and
those people would... Yeah,
and charged with terrorist court charges, which is so absurd.
So
yes.
Disgusting, isn't it? Yeah.
So, and of course, yes, so the climate has changed and, you know, people, they've fear has been whipped up about that, so people are not so outraged when yeah. people are treated badly. Yeah, yeah. So, yes.
Where do you think Greenham sort of sits in the... Because I was just thinking when you were talking about the other things that were happening in the law, the other big campaigns that were going to happen, and also the idea of us having words for things like domestic violence and sexual abuse and things like that, that those things really came out of the radical feminist movement, to even name them and to count them and to catalogue those crimes and respond to them as a, you know, as a body of criminality. Where do you think Greenham sort of sits within that radical feminist movement? Is it?
I think it's slightly different. I think it's because domestic violence and sexual abuse and so on. Really highlight how the personal is the political. Mm-hmm. Whereas the peace women, it was a much more, I mean, overtly political, I won't say simply political, but it was a political movement, whereas mm-hmm. Women's Aid, domestic violence and all the work around sex abuse and rape and so on, has arisen in a different way. It's arisen from, you know, people's personal experiences. So I think it's different. But of course, there are those connections. And because some women did go to the camp to escape some of that, to escape sexual abuse and domestic violence. And so they are interlinked. Mm. But I suppose... Yes.
Do you think that the radical feminist movement that had such successes in the 70s and 80s until, I'd say, backlash of the 90s, mm. but certainly the 70s and 80s, could Greenham have happened without it and vice versa? I suppose, do you think they come out of a similar...
Well, the women's movement, I mean, I think you have to be careful how you use the term radical feminist, just because...
Yes, true, the women's movement.
Because
I was thinking particularly second wave... sort of second wave women's movement, I suppose, at that time.
No. Because you've got socialist feminist, you've got radical feminist, and you've got revolutionary feminist during the 70s and 80s.
So women's movement covers all of those.
Yes, so you've got to be kind of careful. And, I mean, because as I say, yes, I mean, my history is that I was living in France and I heard about Erin Pitsey and Chiswick Refuge, and I thought that sounded... You know, just the whole issue was very interesting. And
what is that? Sorry, I didn't right. reference.
Right. So Erin Pitsey was a woman who started the Chiswick Women's Aid Refuge.
Okay.
And in fact, at the time, a lot of other groups started and were working with Erin Pitsey. I was living in France. I heard about it. I thought, you know, domestic violence. It was a concept that I knew nothing about. Mm. You know, hadn't appeared in my life at all. Mm. But I thought it was interesting. But I did not want to be a feminist. My sister was a feminist. I did not want to be a feminist. Anyway, because I thought it was all about consciousness raising, and I thought it was a waste of time. So when I came back to England, I was teaching, and a bloke I was teaching with said, oh, you're interested in domestic violence. There's a women's group starting and they're going to be involved in a refuge in Leicester. I was living in Leicester. And so I went along, kind of reluctantly, because it was a women's group, but I did want to be involved in Women's Aid. But by the meeting was so wonderful, and all these women who were there were so wonderful, that by the end of it, I'd signed up for every group going, you know, abortion, women's aid, working women's charter, consciousness, everything. It was so lovely. And then I became involved in women's aid, and then I worked in the national office. I mean, that's how that happened. But the thing, I mean, in those days, it was wonderful. The women's movement for women, it just meant that, you know, you could be anywhere in the world and you would just find your local women's group and you would have chums, you know. And it was a lovely, lovely time. And I feel really sorry for women that that doesn't exist in the same way now. Mm. So to go back to your point, I think in a way... the Green Movement was a sort of natural development. It, you know, women working together, women, you know, the idea was not strange that women should feel that they together can work together to make some sort of political change. And I mean, I don't know exactly what conversations went on when those women in Wales got together, first of all, but I imagine it was something of that sort. And they walked, you know, started their long march to Newbury.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because one of the things that we were saying earlier, both of us, that people haven't heard, younger people haven't heard of Greenham, and it is so surprising. And it's very easy to make them go, wow, really? How did that happen? Something. The concept seems like, where could that have come? It's so surprising. Whereas actually, like you're just saying, it sort of might not have felt, it sounds like it was almost the next logical step if you were part of the women's movement, or even if you were just in a culture that was,
well, if you read itself, the newspaper, you know, virtually, and saw what was going on in the world. So, yeah, I think it was just easier for women to get together, and it was just accepted. I mean, it hadn't been easy until the 70s and the 80s, or the 70s. It was certainly the early 80s.
Why would that be the case? If you'd think that now, with mobile phones and the internet and things, this would be the zenith of women getting together, and it would be the easiest it's ever been. But
it's different, isn't it? But there's the whole thing about phones just keep us locked into our room, just on the phone or on the computer. And then, you know, it's a different world. Women get together for different reasons now, you know, for hen nights and stuff like that, and baby showers, which is, you know, different. And it's a different way of being. I mean, partly because the women's movement in the 70s and 80s was so successful, and so, you know, our work here is done, we thought for a moment, but now realise that's not true. But I think, you know, a lot of younger women are benefiting from, you know, those campaigns. I think they will also begin to realise that, you know, they're at risk of losing that, you know, that it's all under threat, nothing can be relied on these days. So, who knows, there may be a new wave of women's activities soon. Who knows?
Yeah. Do you think it's important that Greenham is remembered? Do you think that fits in that? Do you think it's an important thing?
Yeah, I do. I mean, yes, because...
And if so, why?
Because it was an important campaign. I mean, it spoke about the relation, you know, it wasn't even British nuclear weapons, they were American. So there was a whole thing about, you know, the relationship between nations. It was a way of responding to a political situation. It was a women's thing. They were fearless and brave, and they used the law, and they, you know, they were canny, they knew how to do it, and they did it. And I think it is, it's one of the, you know, the campaigns that one learns about, you know, the Tolpuddle Martyrs, the suffragettes, you know, the Chartists.
Rebellion.
Yeah, it's all of, you know, it's part of that spectrum. Yeah.
And yet it's fallen out of conversation to a large degree. I think it's been brought back, actually. There's lots of different projects I see. Not just, you know, there seems to be lots of people going, but I wonder why Greenham has fallen out.
I think a lot of things, I don't think it's just Greenham, I think a lot of things have fallen out of people's memory. You know,
it's more at risk of it falling out if it's to do with women, or is that just...
No, not necessarily, because we all remember the suffragettes, don't we? So, you know, people have forgotten the Tolpuddle Martyrs, I would imagine, and the hunger marches, you know, people have forgotten things that have happened. I mean, people have forgotten about Northern Ireland, you know, and so...
Fairly soon, weren't they?
Sadly. So, yeah, so, no, I don't think there's anything specifically anti-women. I mean, because there were lots of other, you know, there were other peace campaigns at the time.
Yeah.
Who also used our defence.
Oh, did they?
And then we had all agreed that we would not appeal it, because because if you appealed using that defence, we knew that we would be struck down. We knew we would be told that was not a proper defence and we couldn't use it.
Okay.
And so that would mean that the women couldn't use, or nobody could
That'd
use
be a
it.
Precedent.
Yes. But where it wasn't challenged, so it hadn't, there'd been no decision on it, we could all carry on using it, but somebody appealed it and
oh,
lost.
No.
Yeah, so, I mean, these things happen.
Damn it.
A male barrister. But anyway, there we are. There we are.
So would you now define as a feminist? After
who,
all
me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Quite quickly changed
yes, yes, yes.
around.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, after about 5 minutes in that small room in Leicester, I became a feminist.
How did your sister feel about that?
Oh, yeah.
Was she like, finally?
Well, probably. I don't. Yeah. Yeah. So, I told you so. Yeah. Yeah.
All the reasons that one doesn't do what the same things as one's
sister. Exactly. Yeah. So that was that. Yeah.
Is there anything that you think I should have asked you that I haven't thought of or that you would like to have covered?
Well, I think we probably have covered most of it, haven't we? I'm just looking through my chapter to see if there was anything.
My questions are mostly based around people who were visited. Yeah. Did you ever visit the camp?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did
yeah.
you spend any nights there?
No, but I did. Well, I went with my mum, but I also went for. Did I? I think I went for the Embrace the Base, and I went some other time. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what was it like?
Oh, well, it's extraordinary, it? You know, just extraordinary.
What are your memories of the actual camp?
Well, just a wonderful place to be. I mean, you know, over and above. I mean, and that was, I think that's why it's so interesting, because over and above the political aspect of it and the purpose, the primary purpose, which was to argue against cruise missiles being in the UK... It was just a wonderful place to be, a wonderful place, you know, of women and everyone behaving well and being supportive and sisterly. And it was just lovely. I mean, yeah, no, I mean, I feel very sorry for all the women who missed out on, not just on Greenham, but all those wonderful things that we did in the 70s and 80s, the women's movement. It was just a fabulous time, you know. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
If there was one thing about Greenham that you would say sort of evokes it for you, what would it be? One image or one memory?
Well, of course, there's the smell of wood smoke. Yeah. I don't know. I suppose it would be probably being in Newbury Magistrates Court with lots of women behind and somebody singing. Probably that would just sort of sum it up, really, you know, because it was so contraindicated in a courtroom. I think probably when I think about Greenham, of course, we used to have to get up about 5 o'clock in the morning to get a train to go down to Newbury, and yeah, they were long days.
And it sounds like there are some cases then that where lots of women were in the court at the same time, is that right?
Well, you see, that was because they would arrest them en masse, so there'd be 20 or 30 or 40 arrests. And so the women would...
Them en masse, yes, as well, would they?
And they, at first, and then they realised that way, disaster.
Life anarchy.
Yes. So we turned up at court and we were told, on one particular day, and were told that the women were going to be dealt with in groups of three. And so the women said to us, oh, no, 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 you can't let that happen. It's not fair. It's unjust. We've all got to be dealt with in the same way, in the same room, at the same time. So Izzy and I went in and we argued. And in the end, the magistrate said, OK, they can all be dealt with together. So in came the women. And that's when the opera started. That's why they'd wanted all to be in the same room at the same time.
That's so funny. Did you ever feel any frustration with them that you'd had to argue for that long and then they'd done that? Or did you just think, great? How was it for you? A mixture?
Yeah, I think so. A mixture. Because, well, you know, because you do your best and then you look like a complete fool. So that, you know, that was, sometimes that was hard. Yeah. You know, you like to think you are a professional and you're doing your job properly and you're, you know,
And you've brought round these other people's opinions, these men's opinions.
Yes, and you've changed their minds and you've argued properly and thoughtfully and then whoosh.
They were naughty, weren't they?
They were. Well, but that was, there you are. That was the greener women.
Yeah.
Yeah. You couldn't expect anything different.
That's lovely. Thank you so much. That's pleasure. Great. I really, really love talking about that with you. It was fascinating. Thank you.